Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say it's time to prepare for the 2018-2019 flu season, recommending almost everyone 6 months and older get a flu vaccination, especially after a horrible season that killed more children than any other non-pandemic year of record. Dr. Red Cross, board-certified internal medicine, says having a strong immune system is a key to protection. He joins us via phone. Dr. Red Cross, welcome to 411 Teen.
Hi there, Liz. How are you? Thank you for having me on, and hello, everyone out there listening.
Well, thanks for coming. You have some information that's very, very valuable, and we certainly can use, because the seasonal flu is a contagious respiratory illness. So those of us who are worried about catching the flu definitely need to listen to this program. We'll start by you telling us, sharing with us, what is the flu or influenza?
Oh, wow. So that's a very important place to start, right? Because we know that each and every year, Liz, we can prepare for the flu. We know that the flu typically comes in October, and believe it or not, can extend all the way out into May. Now, you highlighted the point last year of how brutal the season was and how unfortunate it was that it affected so many of our children, and it extended all the way out into June last year. So you're right, Liz. The CDC says that now is the time to prepare. So to your question of what is influenza, influenza is actually a virus, and that's important as we'll talk later today. But the fact that it's a virus, it's a pesky virus. It's one that is able to kind of change the way that it is, which is the reason why when we get the flu shot, sometimes we have a challenge. Last year, the flu shot was about 37% effective, but it was only 24% effective at the most virulent strain, or the strongest strain, as we say. And so that was why it was a little challenging for us last year. But this year, we hope to have a flu shot that's a little more accurate, a little more effective. But that's the point, is that the flu is a tough one, as it can change itself even throughout the season, Liz.
So what I hear you saying is that this virus mutates, right?
There you go. And that's the best way to say it, exactly what it can do. Now, we try to anticipate that. So I should also point out that there's different types of flu viruses. There's influenza A, influenza B, and there's a couple of more, too, or several more, I should say. But those are the big two that we try to make sure that we include in the vaccine each and every year. The influenza A tends to be a little bit more aggressive. Influenza B tends to be the milder one that lasts only a few days and we kind of can get over it. But you're right. That's the key. It can absolutely mutate, and even throughout the season when we think we have it kind of pegged.
And I would guess that that would relate to the effectiveness of the vaccine that you may have, because if the vaccine is for one version and another version is prolific, then that's why it may not work as well.
Well, you know what I should say, Liz? So you know what I should clarify, and I'm glad you said that, because so when we get the vaccines, everyone, it comes in trivalent or quadrivalent. So in other words, tri means that there's three strains that it will protect you, and the quadrivalent means that there's four strains that you'll be protected against. Now, those are the strains that tend to be the most aggressive and the most common. So you don't have to go to your doctor and say, hey, I want that particular vaccine for this strain or that strain. We have you covered, so you don't have to worry about picking and choosing. We get the stronger strains and the more common ones that you'll probably see during the season.
Well, which one would you recommend people getting, the tri or the quad?
Well, then that's the other thing. You don't really have to make that decision. Most of the times, we all get the trivalent. The quadrivalent are in specific circumstances, sometimes small children, sometimes those who are chronically ill. But the trivalent is the one that we typically get, and we have for years. So we know we're trying to do some different things with the flu vaccine. And even, Liz, they're even trying a study that will give you immunity for the entire year. We're not there yet. But the point is, we're trying to think a little bit outside the box going forward.
Well, I think that's good, because I think I know of some folks who have had the flu already. Now, is that possible?
Well, look, typically we see it towards October, but I'll tell you, I mean, the flu kind of has a mind of its own, right? And so it's important that you feel like you come down with some of those symptoms, which I guess I should point out now. So some of the symptoms that you'll have with the flu are the fever, the chills, and the body aches in particular. Last year, I saw patients that had a lot of those, but sometimes they just came in with body aches and headache, for instance. So it was a little bit of a unique season in that way. Now, our children will present a little bit differently. Children can obviously have the fever, but they typically can have a rash with it, especially if they're small. They also, you start to recognize that they're not eating the same way. So you see that the kids just don't look like our kids to know that a little bit more is going on. But obviously, they're not so good, Liz, at saying, hey, Mom and Dad, I'm having some body aches and so forth. They don't
that's
do it
true.
That way. So you have to look at your child and know that, hey, that's not little Jimmy there.
Okay. Well, exactly how is the virus spread? How is it contracted?
Yeah, so it's a respiratory illness. So it's spread through respiratory droplets. And the studies are showing you can spread the flu, and this is just one cough. You can spread it about 6 feet. And when you cough, if you're not covering your mouth, you can shoot about 2,000 virus-laden particles to someone. So we have to be careful, and we have to make sure that we're covering our mouth. We're really supposed to be sneezing or coughing into the crook of our arm. You're supposed to kind of put it up to really make sure it's a barrier. And I'm glad that that's kind of getting out there now. But the point is that it's highly infectious. And I guess we'll talk about some things today because I typically focus on the flu as far as spreading in the workplace and when we're out and about. But this year, I kind of wanted to go room by room at home.
Yes, we're going to get to that. Yes, yes. I have a couple other questions I wanted to go over with you, and then we'll get to that.
Sure.
One was just, how long or when is one contagious, and for how long are they contagious?
That's another good question. So by the time you have the symptoms, you were probably contagious a day before that. The other thing is, it's another good question, because how long are we infectious afterwards? Well, for us, it can be 4 to 5 days and up to 7 after, but kids can be even longer. So that's why it's important when you talk about your children and sending them to school and sending them back too soon and that sort of thing. It becomes increasingly important.
Well, we talk about the virus being spread by droplets, and my question would be, how long do these droplets last on different surfaces? I mean, like if they are on plastic or if they're on a paper towel, what do we have to worry about as far as that's concerned?
Well, that's a tough one because, as I mentioned, it's a pesky virus. So we know on hard surfaces, Liz, believe it or not, it can live 24 hours, which is a long
time.
That's
a long time.
That's a long time for a virus, right? Especially
right.
when you're coming somewhere, even at your desk at work and not knowing that someone may have sneezed and coughed, and this was yesterday, and it's still there. So, you know, it's something to definitely keep in mind.
Okay. And how severe can it be?
Yeah, and unfortunately, the flu virus is something that we have to take seriously. That's why it's always good when this season comes for the flu, because everyone is usually aware or cognizant, Liz, that, okay, the season is upon us, and I can always go to start talking early about getting ready for it. So the flu, even last year, it hospitalized over 700,000 Americans. We talked about over the 170 deaths that we saw in children, and we are not even talking about the complications that also led to death. And the number one complication for influenza is pneumonia, and it's a bacterial pneumonia that's usually the cause of some of the complications, the number one cause of death from the flu, complication-wise. So, you know, it's important that we really recognize how serious the flu can be. And I get that the flu vaccine could be controversial, Liz, but you need to make sure you reach out to your doc. Each and every one of us has a different story to tell as far as our medical history. And we know some people, no matter what, need to have it. I mean, I would say that most of us should, especially after last year. I think we need to be careful. But I get that some of my patients are a little resistant, and so I try to work with them on some other alternatives, which we'll probably even cover later today.
Okay. What populations? I would think the very young, infants, and the elderly are at high risk. But are there other high-risk populations that we need to be aware of?
Well, actually, Liz, you hit the nail right on the head. Usually it's small children. These are the populations where we tend to, unfortunately, see the mortality. You said the younger, so we're talking 6 months, under a year, that sort of thing. And then the elderly, the ones who are 65 and older. But I will tell you this, last year, the studies were showing that we were having a big problem with increased illness and death in the group that's 50 to 65. And that was the first time in a long time, because that's a group that usually is able to escape a little. Mm-hmm. But we saw that they were heavily affected last year. So it's just another reason for us to be ready for this year and take it seriously, especially if we're in that age group.
What do you speculate caused that, to see that change? Because that is a group, that 50 group, are usually don't have that level of severity.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's because it was that stronger strain, the H3N2 strain, which is the most aggressive. And as I mentioned before, the vaccine last year didn't do so well against that strain. It did well with influenza B, and it did well with a couple of other strains that are influenza A strains, but it did not do well at the most aggressive strain. So I think that's the reason why we were hit so hard last year.
In these last few minutes before we take a quick break, mm-hmm. at what point does one go to a physician? Because I think a lot of people kind of feel like they can ride it through. But there are times when you need to intervene. And at what point would you recommend patients come in?
I think there's two things to think about. Number one, I always say if you have a fever for over 2 days, so in other words, if you get to that third day and you're still having the fever, and I mean a fever without taking the Tylenol or anything else to reduce it, then that's an issue. I need to see you. The other thing is, if you're chronically ill, Liz, if you have congestive heart failure, you have COPD, or if you're a smoker, or you're at increased risk, diabetic, if you realize that you're sick for the first couple of days, I'm pretty aggressive there. I need you to come in, because I know that your immune system is already somewhat reduced or suppressed, and so I want to see you get you early before some of the problems actually start to occur.
Okay. With the vaccinations, how long does it take for one to develop the antibodies?
Oh, wow. It can take up to a couple of weeks for the vaccine to actually kick in, which is the reason why it's important that we make that decision and come in to make sure that we get it, especially towards the early part of the season. Now, the CDC mentioned coming in towards the end of October. And I know they are very bright, and they know what they're talking about, but I am a little more cautious. So I talk to patients a lot about coming in at the beginning of October, only because I think about that window, and I want those antibodies to kick in a little early. But the CDC is obviously talking through some data that probably says we don't have to, but I'm just telling you personally, I'm just a little more aggressive with that.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we will return in 60 seconds. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and this hour we are looking at the flu. Dr. Ken Red Cross, board-certified internal medicine, is joining us to share his expertise and experience with the flu. I have to say this. I just love your name. Now, did you plan it that way?
That is, let me tell you, that is my God-given name.
Okay.
God knows I'm busy. I answer it every day. And I love it each and every time. But yes, ma'am, it is my official name.
Okay. All right. As we look at this flu and the flu season 2018-2019, what have we learned? What have we learned from last year to this year about the flu?
Yeah, I think the first thing we learned is that the flu is serious business. So it's not time to kind of blow it off and kind of say, nah, I'm not going to go there. It's not a biggie. I'm afraid it's going to give me the flu, which I'll tell everyone, the flu vaccine does not give you the flu. Okay? It's an inactivated
I'm so glad to
virus.
Hear you say that. Yes.
It is not coming back to life to infect you, okay? So I promise you. And then the other thing is not only to take it seriously, of course, but also to recognize the symptoms, fevers, chills, body aches, headaches, sometimes abdominal pain, anything around this time of year that really, really just wears you down. And it happens quickly, Liz. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The flu versus the cold. The cold kind of meanders, kind of just slowly comes on you. But the flu, it hits you like a ton of bricks. And when it hits you and takes you down for the count a little bit, you know you may be dealing with something else a little bit more than a common cold.
Mm-hmm. And since it's viral, do you treat the symptoms basically and allow it to run its course? How is that addressed?
Well, it depends. So some of the things we'll touch on today are helpful, but the other thing, and I thought you were going to ask, which I will highlight here, the point is, since it's viral, you have to make sure that you treat the symptoms almost mm-hmm. symptomatically
mm-hmm.
And make sure, like, if you have this issue, if you're having nasal stuffiness, we deal with this. If mm-hmm. you're having the chills, we deal with that. But one thing that doesn't help, Liz, are antibiotics.
Oh, right.
And so I wanted to make sure that people didn't go into the doctor and get upset if their doctor said, no, I can't give you anything, and you leave a little empty-handed. But it's only because we're practicing best practices, we call them, and we know that antibiotics are for bacteria. They're not for viruses. So if anything, that may increase your risk for other side effects that you do not need to deal with.
In prevention, how important is general hygiene? I mean, like washing hands, is soap, yeah. are alcohol-based rubs better, alcohol more effective? What about chlorine? Would you talk about that?
Sure. There's mm-hmm. nothing better than good old soap and water. Okay. Soap and water is the best way. Now, for instance, I'm in New York City. It's not always easy to be near a bathroom that you have access to use soap and water. So I use like a natural hand gel that I personally get from Whole Foods or what have you. And it's all natural. There's no paraffins. There's nothing in that but just the pureness of the 99% effectiveness for bacteria. So I do that when I'm out and about. But mm-hmm. if I'm home, there's nothing, and I mean nothing, everyone, better than soap and water. And let's make sure you're really washing them. The old adage of singing happy birthday to me or happy birthday to someone two times
okay.
Is about 20 seconds. And that's beneficial to make sure that we're washing our hands long enough to really make sure we're getting rid of anything that's on our hands that can infect us.
Okay. Will you make a distinction, I just got this question, between seasonal mm-hmm. flu and what some folks call stomach flu?
Oh, okay. So that's interesting. So mm-hmm. even though we use the name stomach flu, mm-hmm. it has nothing at all to mm-hmm. do with
flu.
Influenza.
Right.
It's kind of something that we've carried over the time. It typically tends to be the norovirus, which is a virus mm-hmm. that you always hear on those cruise ships
mm-hmm.
when everyone mm-hmm. comes down sick, everyone's been eating in the same buffet.
Yeah.
And you'll hear it that way. That typically is a norovirus. Obviously, there's other viruses as well, but it's sometimes kind of it's a misnomer to really call it a stomach flu. They're not. It's not related to influenza, put it that way.
Okay. All right. Should one consult a physician before being vaccinated? You know, you can be vaccinated at so many different places now. You
sure,
can go to the
sure.
pharmacy. You can go to the grocery store. There might be some freestanding place that you can go. For those who haven't been vaccinated, they're going to get vaccinated. Where should they go? Should they go to their physician, or should they consult their physician even before they are vaccinated?
You know, that was a question I would have answered differently even some years ago, because
mm-hmm.
we used to, for instance, avoid the flu vaccine in those who had egg allergies.
Mm-hmm.
But now we know that we do not have to do that. So I would say you can go anywhere to where you know it's a reputable place, whether it be some of the pharmacies, the natural food stores, that sort of thing. It doesn't have to be at your physician's office. I would hate for everyone to wait for an appointment or something along
right.
those lines. We know, we talked about the age group, if you're over 6 months, you can get it. And so it's important to try to beat the flu to the point, which is back to that prevention that you talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Well, you hear so much about, what is it, Tamiflu? And
right.
How effective is it? When should it be utilized?
So here's the challenge with Tamiflu. So Tamiflu, which Liz is mentioning, everyone, is something that you use when you have the flu-like symptoms. Now, it's only good within that first 48-hour window.
Okay.
And what I typically find, Liz, is it's tough because a lot of patients don't really get to me until 72 hours
mm-hmm.
or later, saying, you know, I thought this was just a cold, but I'm not getting better, or they've been stuck in bed and so forth. So, number one, it's a little tough to get to that window when Tamiflu tends to be the most effective. And then the other thing which can be a challenge for some is, you know, with anything, that's especially that some of our prescriptions can have side effects. And so some people will complain of some nausea and some other things with it. So not only are you maybe not within that range to give it, but you have to also consult about side effects. But look, for some that are in that window and happen to be fortunate enough, you know, the studies have shown, yes, it can decrease a little bit of the severity. It doesn't wipe it out.
Okay.
But once again, you have to balance that with the risk-benefit ratio as well.
And as we talk about risk, what are the complications that can be, you know, that can come from getting the flu? And are there any populations that are recommended not to get vaccinated? I would think people who may have compromised immune systems, I don't know, but who should, are there any populations that we do not vaccinate? And
well,
if so,
no,
why?
Actually, Liz, those ones that were under the 6 months that you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
those are the ones we don't vaccinate because
okay.
their little immune systems are getting used to
okay.
the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for those who have suppressed immune systems, cancer patients, patients who are older, those are the ones that need it.
Okay.
Because the virus is looking at them as opportunistic. It's trying
mm-hmm.
to prey on that immune system. So those are the ones that really need it. So a great question, but you know, there's really no one that I can think of that really shouldn't get it, obviously, unless they have a specific allergy to something in the
mm-hmm.
the vaccine, which you rarely ever see, something like that. But for the most part, no, just the ones
okay.
that are younger than 6 months where it's not indicated. But a very, very good question there.
Well, I tell you, I talked with someone. Now, she is compromised. She has lupus, and she got
mm-hmm.
the flu. Was vaccinated, and she swears that she thought it made her sick and it made her have an episode, and
mm-hmm.
that, and she felt like maybe she should not have been vaccinated. That's what prompted my question to you about who should not be vaccinated.
Yeah, and then we also mentioned before, remember I mentioned earlier, Liz, about there being different strains of the flu?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
it's possible she could have been vaccinated for the common strains but got another strain
mm-hmm.
around the same time, and the vaccine takes 2 weeks to kick in. So you're right. You know, some patients will kind of associate that with some of the flu vaccines, but I'll tell you, especially for her for lupus, we want to be careful with keeping her immune system, strong and support her. But I understand you will have certain patients that have some causal type feel, they think, with the vaccine and some sort of syndrome or something that happens from that. But once again, it's important to make sure you're talking to your doc throughout the process.
What complications can the flu involve? And when I say complications, I'm thinking, and I may be thinking wrong, so you redirect me, of folks who have problems with ear infections or sinus
mm-hmm.
infections or diabetes. I mean, do they have more complications with the flu?
Well, they can. And
okay.
that's back to the immune system again, right? It's
right,
back to
right.
what things are you susceptible to. The number one complication, as I mentioned before, is pneumonia. But sure, there are some other manifestations that you can have with the flu. They tend to be more pulmonary, meaning involving the lungs,
mm-hmm.
That sort of thing, whether it be a bronchitis or flaring up someone who has COPD, or in other words, emphysema or chronic bronchitis. But it tends to be localized there. There were also some newer studies about it affecting maybe some of our lymph nodes as well, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Our lymph nodes are there to help clear viruses and bacteria and fungus and so forth, too. But, yeah, it tends to be, in the upper respiratory tract, if anything. Well, actually upper and lower respiratory tract in particular.
We hear scares about, oh, what was that flu? Bird flu or avian flu. Share with us just what is that about?
Yeah, so that was 2001, and that
mm-hmm.
was another strain of the flu. It was
okay.
H1N1. A lot of people remember that because it was just so distinctive a name, but it was the H1N1 virus once again. It was one of these strange flus that mutated. We called it the avian
mm-hmm.
virus at the time, but it mutated, and that's the thing that we always have to be careful about. And, you know, one of the things I always talk to patients about when they say, okay, you know, I'm going to get my flu vaccine, but I want to think of some different, some natural ways. I always talk to patients about, like, flu-fighting foods, things
mm-hmm.
that we can have in our refrigerators that can
mm-hmm.
make a big difference, because I want everyone to recognize, hey, there's some things that that we can use in our refrigerators that are just like medicine. Food is medicine. And I wanted to remember that over and over again.
Well, we're definitely going to get into that. I know when one has the flu, they're always advised to drink plenty, get plenty of rest,
right,
and drink lots of fluids,
right,
and avoid alcohol and tobacco use. But I want to ask you, before we really got into the specifics of how we adapt our environment, or at least mm-hmm. become aware of our environment, what about the use of aspirin during flu? Mm-hmm. I remember when the use of aspirin could lead to Reye's syndrome and a liver disease, right? So what about the use of aspirin? Will you address that?
Sure. So a couple of things that are going on. In fact, I was just doing a piece yesterday here in New York about there's a newer study on aspirin. You were talking about Reye syndrome,
mm-hmm.
which is something that you can see with, it was in children. So those who are 18 and younger are advised not to take aspirin for symptoms or to take it at all because of the potential for Reye syndrome.
Right.
But it's something that we need to focus on. The big news as far as with aspirin is not necessarily centered around flu, but it's centered around aspirin and preventing heart attacks and strokes like we thought for certain patient populations. And instead of everyone just being on it, once again, it's another discussion to have with your doc to see if you're one of those folks that should be on an aspirin.
Okay, so that's a time you really do need to consult your for some of these
Absolutely.
Things. I mean, you know, Absolutely. You might get the flu, you might feel achy, you know, you might not be up as spry as you usually are, but that's something, that use of aspirin is something that you really do need to consult.
That is that's just for when you're talking about for heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as for the flu or flu-like
mm-hmm.
symptoms, that is a no discussion there. No need to take an aspirin, especially or in particular, I should say, if you're 18 and younger.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about the prognosis of the flu? I mean,
mm-hmm.
what can one expect in recovery? On the average, and I know everybody is an individual, but on the average, how long does it usually take to recover from the flu?
Well, once again, it's very specific, as you pointed out. You know, we'll say 3 to 7 days. For some people, it goes a little bit longer. We're back to that older patient that's a smoker or that's a diabetic to where it may linger a little more. Then you have the young millennials, the 25-year-olds who get the flu and bounce back in a couple of days. But on average, we'll say that the flu lasts about 3 to 7 days. It's a 3 to 7 days that you will not forget.
Okay.
Most people usually don't forget when they have the flu versus the cold because they always will associate it with that year. 2016, I had the worst virus ever. You know, everyone kind of knows when it's the flu or influenza. And as far as your question of prognosis, directly, it kind of depends on your age, your medical history, and a few other things. And more importantly, how soon you catch it. It's always about how soon you catch it to really help with your prognosis.
Well, if you catch it, do you develop? Of course, it's continually mutating. So I think I can answer my question, but do you develop a resistance to it? If you have had the flu, I mean, do you maintain those antibodies?
No, we're talking about a year out.
Mm-hmm.
So there has been some studies to show there may be a couple of antibodies lingering around if you're lucky and if it's the same strain that we see the next year. Now, when we talk about those mutations, when you have that flu in that particular one, it's not necessarily that it's mutating throughout your body at the moment. It's just mutating before it's exposed to us, which is why I say it's hard to kind of say, we're going to get each and every flu to come to us. Because even if we get that flu, it may have already kind of changed on us a little bit, which is the reason why it may be a little more aggressive than we had anticipated before.
Well, I have one more question. And I'm smiling as I think about it, but I'm thinking, why does the flu seem to occur seasonally instead of uniformly throughout the North? I mean, for example, I'm thinking, we say the flu reaches its peak prevalence in the winter, but that's in the northern hemisphere. What about the southern hemisphere when they have winter at Does this make sense for me to ask you when they have winter
at
different times?
In fact, let me tell you, it's a very astute question. So it's a fabulous question. And the reason why I say that is because we know that it's based on the seasonal patterns because of the temperature of the air.
Okay,
right. It's a virus that loves that cool, dry air, and mm-hmm. it really gets moving around then. So each of these viruses and bacteria that we deal with each and every day, they all have a little something that they like, something mm-hmm. that they thrive in. And influenza, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, because we can at least kind of get ready for it or prepare. But, yeah, it likes that cold, dry air, which is why we can kind of know that it's coming our way seasonally each and every year. But that's a really, really good question.
Okay. So those who may be traveling to different hemispheres really need to take that, you know, under consideration.
An excuse to go to Barbados.
Right. That sounds good to me, you know. Oh, goodness. Well, what does, and I guess I'll just hold because we're going to take a break. I was going to ask you about, the current research, and then I wanted to get into how we adapt our homes, what we do. I mean, because I know in your book, which was really great. I mean, we'll have to talk about it. I liked talking about the relationship and fostering a relationship with your physician. So we'll get into that in a second. You're tuned into 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I've been talking with Dr. Ken Redcross. We are looking at the flu and how you can de-flu your house is coming up. We're going to talk about things that you can do to maybe lessen the blow. We'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? Dr. Ken Redcross is a board-certified internal medicine physician. He completed his medical training at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in 2001. He's also written a new book that's out called Bond: The Four Cornerstones of a Lasting and Caring Relationship with Your Doctor. Dr. Redcross, you emphasize the one's environment surrounding them can make a difference as to whether or not you will catch the flu. And I wanted to have you talk about tackling influenza room by room and keeping those unwanted germs from invading your space and lowering your chances of getting sick. So I know you've gone through even some things that you may incorporate in your diet and wanted to really elaborate on it this last section of the program. So would you share that? I mean, we might start with the kitchen. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And we should think of it as, what can we put in our kitchens, guys, that are actually immune boosters or mm-hmm. flu-fighting foods, I like to call them this time of year. And what we'll do is we'll start with my favorite fruit. My favorite fruit this time of year are cranberries. Mm-hmm. Now, cranberries are interesting. They're high in polyphenols. Now, polyphenols are, when everyone learns a little bit about antioxidants, that's what polyphenols are. They help us fight disease. They help to clear up some of the material that our cells use to fight disease. Mm-hmm. And cranberries also had a study in the nutrition journal that showed that they, in fact, can boost our immune system. But when we're thinking about vegetables are the big ones. So vegetables, mushrooms in particular, the shiitake mushroom. The shiitake mushroom is antiviral, it's antibacterial, and it's also antifungal. Now, I know some people love mushrooms and some have a different view, but one way you can get it in addition to taking it in your diet is through a highly effective medicinal mushroom booster, which is called AHCC. Now, Liz, when I'm talking about a lot of these things, even the cranberries, I mentioned studies, and AHCC has over 30 human clinical trials. And they have a website, which is ahccresearch.org, where you can learn about what they do. to help to increase your immunity, decrease your inflammation, things that we need to have happen should we have flu-like symptoms. So it's a very big deal to recognize food and to recognize how something as simple as this fruit and this vegetable can make such a big difference in your life and to making sure you're staying healthy at that time.
Okay. What are the things that we can do or use in the kitchen that may cut down on the transmission of germs? And I'm just thinking, like, you know, should we use paper cups? Are paper cups more efficient than using your typical glass? I mean, what about paper towels? Towels may be more... They seem like they would be better than, you know, how somebody might have a towel and you dry your hands on the towel and then somebody else wipes their hands on the towel and someone else wipes their hands on the towel. I don't know. But I'm just presenting those to you because I'd like to hear your take on it, what you say.
No, you're right, because you want to make sure. Remember we talked earlier in the show about making sure to wipe those surfaces down because mm-hmm. that virus can live 24 hours on hard surfaces?
Right.
Well, that goes for our kitchen. It goes for our bathroom. It goes for everywhere in our home. So you want to make sure that you're wiping down with antibacterial wipes. The other thing you mentioned, too, when you talked about the paper towels, or I should just say the hand towels, especially in our bathroom, get rid of those hand towels. Think about some of those paper towels, the kind of fancy paper towels you can put in your bathroom with that nice little holder. Get mm-hmm. rid of those because you want to make sure that you throw them into the trash can, but you want the trash can to have a lid on it because we know that the flu virus can live up to 15 minutes on tissue. So we have to make sure that we stamp it out right there at the source.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, I hope folks heard that for sure. Anything else about bathrooms? Our kitchen, wiping off countertops and all of that. How effective should we use Clorox bleach or what? Chlorine or what should we use?
No, very important. And lots of times the antibacterial wipes and mm-hmm. all of them will let you know that they're about 99% effective. So you have to make sure that you're wiping the surfaces down, but you want to make sure that the surfaces actually are wet when you wipe them down.
Oh,
that's how you know that there's enough solution at the time.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Because sometimes, that is a very good point. And bedrooms. What about bedrooms?
Everything's
so specific, I would think. Just first of all, if you have a partner or a mate or whatever, you might want to sleep in separate rooms. sounds awful, doesn't it?
It's time to separate at least for the night, right? Or at least for the next couple of nights.
Nice.
Three to maybe seven nights. It depends. But the important thing is we want to make sure that we're washing the linen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important to do. I usually tell everyone every 4 to 7 days. I know it's not easy, but even if it's once a week, you have to make sure that you're washing those linens and getting rid of that virus. We've talked a lot about how pesky it is. And don't forget about your living room.
Mm-hmm.
That remote control.
That
remote control
mm-hmm.
Needs to be almost soaked sometimes. But you want to make sure that you're wiping it and wiping off your iPad screens and your phone screens, that sort of thing, to make sure as well that you're wiping down and getting rid of any virus.
And something I'd like to go back to with as far as the bed, lots of times people will change their sheets, but they need to change their blankets too, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I want them to literally wash everything.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure you're doing that. That will make sure that the virus is, in fact, dead or killed. And you need to do that at least a couple of times, especially when everyone in the home and everyone's trying to stay out of harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I should mention, too, Liz, when I was in the kitchen, I should have also mentioned the importance of protein, of cold water fish in particular. I always mention things such as salmon, tuna.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only because of the omega-3. The omega-3 has been shown to increase our white blood cell count. And so the next thing patients will say, okay, how do I know I'm getting enough? And I always mention a website for them called nutrientpower.org. And if you order a kit there, you'll get a finger stick. You get what's called an omega-3 index to let you know how, if you're getting enough omega-3. It should be around 8. And the other good thing with the test at the nutrientpower.org website is you also get the vitamin D level there, too, which is incredibly important, again, for your immune system. So, once again, we're just back to remembering that food
mm-hmm.
is medicine.
Mm-hmm. And what about opening the windows, getting some fresh air? Sometimes, you know, the house or the apartment or condo is closed up and you just have that, you know, that AC or the heat. But maybe the fresh air might, I don't know, might be beneficial. I always like to have a little fresh air.
No, and I always think it's good that this time of year. It's funny, you'll see different studies that'll show whether it's a big deal or not, but
I know.
Think it's good, even just mentally. You just kind of want that thing out of your home. You want to air it out. It's kind of like that spring cleaning type of mind state, but you're just kind of flipping it to get some clean, fresh air in there and not get any of these particles that are floating in our air that we don't see and getting that out of the house for a bit. So I'm like you. I always talk with patients a lot about just cracking the window, even though it may be a little nippy outside, but let's get some fresh air in there.
Now, what about our pets? We haven't talked about pets. What about other animals? Does the influenza infect other animal species? I mean,
not
I know
in the same way.
Not okay.
Yeah, not in the same way. They can get, you know, you don't necessarily have to worry about infecting them per se because they get certain disease states that we don't get as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that, look, all these viruses, even the ones that affect our pets, some of them can be a little similar, but they all affect them differently. And there's always a different strain or a different genus or what have you to the particular virus or bacteria that infects them. So I wouldn't worry directly, but it's still important to just make sure that you have your pets kind of out of the way so that they're not jumping on countertops and passing it to you when you're touching their paws and
right.
everything. Even as an animal lover,
right?
I'm going to tell everyone to be a little careful with Fido there.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a big dog lover, so that's what made me ask you that. I thought, let me ask him, see what he has to say. In these last few minutes, I guess we've got about 6-7 minutes, I'd like to mm-hmm. explore your book with you. Bond. The new book is Bond by Ken Redcross, The Four Cornerstones of a Lasting and Caring Relationship with Your Doctor. And I think it's very insightful because the relationship that one fosters with their physician and the physician with their patient could be very beneficial. To agree or disagree?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. It's almost like I even mentioned in the book, it's important that your doctors feel like a member of your family because when you have that feeling, things start to come in that are very important. Those cornerstones that I talk about, the
mm-hmm.
trust. The trust starts to come into play. You trust your doctor's recommendation. You are someone who's a little nervous about the flu vaccine, but the doctor's telling you this time, this is not a year to play around. We know it's more aggressive, but you trust them, and you're going to go ahead, and you're going to listen to the recommendations. And then there's respect. You want to make sure that your doctor also respects your decision and make sure that you say, well, I do want the flu vaccine, but I need to discuss this and feel better about that and be able to have that discussion. And then the empathy. So now let's say you come down with the flu and the doctor told you to get your flu shot, Liz, but you didn't get it. You want to make sure your doctor is empathetic to say, it's okay, Miss Liz. I know you didn't get it, but let's take care of you now. Let's make you feel better. And last but not least, communication is that other cornerstone. And that communication is once again to discuss, hey, what happened? Why do you think I got the flu? I didn't get the shot. What do you think I should do next year? What should I look out for? It's that communication. And those things are so important. And right now, healthcare in itself, I feel like it's on a little bit of life support on its own because we're so busy.
Mm-hmm.
And it can feel for a lot of patients like a mill. So
yes.
I wanted to get the book that slowed the process down for everyone to figure out how to navigate the doctor's visit
mm-hmm.
and hopefully get to that patient nirvana, as I like to call it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, to talk a little, and I know I don't think you talked about this in your book, and this is just a side, mm-hmm. but I think people would like to know, how does one select a physician? What should they
mm-hmm.
look at? I mean, you know, you have so many. Well, here we have doc in a box places. That's what my husband calls them, where you can go and you just see whoever is there, and
right.
you know, you don't get treated. It seems like, you know, you talked about trust. Well, trust is something that evolves. You don't just automatically go in and they start trusting you and you start trusting them. So you have to develop a relationship. And this relationship, I mean, is developed by you maintaining or having the same physician for a while so you get to know him or her and vice versa. So if you're running into these, I'm not cracking on doc in a box places, but how do you develop a relationship with your physician if you don't have one? And how do you select one?
Or if you're just meeting them. Yeah, right. You're right. And one of the things I talk about is I did mention in the book that, you know, it's important to ask family members and friends if they know a good doc that they love and why do they love them. Mm-hmm. The other thing I talk with patients about as well is kind of as you look in your book, you want to make sure you have an appointment. You make an appointment with the doctor just for a meet and greet. Mm-hmm. I know the only caveat there is that, you may have to pay your copay, whether it's $20 or $30. But the point is, I say you want to interview your doctor. You want to see if you think you mesh, if there's an energy between the two of you. You know, and that's important when you know, like, you go see the doctor for the first time and they're sitting, they're giving you eye contact, they're not looking in the computer the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of say to yourself, okay, this can work. And I heard from a good friend that he or she was a good doctor or that sort of thing. But you're right, it's an active process. And that's what I mentioned in the book. It's not easy to necessarily just waltz up and get lucky. Hopefully it happens to everyone listening, but sometimes it doesn't. And if it doesn't, to the point that you mentioned, what can we do about it? So hopefully some of these things can be beneficial. And I also mentioned how even when you get there, if it's not quite what you think, how you can speak to your doctor and say, you know, we're almost there. I love my little cornerstones, but we're just missing a little bit more of that empathy. Can you, you know, let's talk, or can I have 15 more minutes of your time next time? That sort of thing.
Yes, and I'm glad you touched on the empathy, because that's another, you know, criticism that physicians may get, that, they don't empathize with the patient. When the patient is trying to tell you, hey, I feel horrible, and you're thinking, hey, you just got the flu. I mean, it'll be okay, you know.
That's the way.
You'll be all right. I mean, that's just the way it is. But I think that's an important point. Did you have anything else you wanted to say just about that as far as the empathy component?
Yeah, and the empathy is something that's interesting, right? Some people feel like when we were in medical school that we were supposed to be a little bit further away from the patient at the point of making sure that you didn't have feelings of transference. In other words, that you were able to stay a little bit of a distance so you can stay kind of objective. But my style's a little different. I mean, look, I adore patients. My personality is one in which I'm not good at the distancing thing, and I don't think I ever was, but I think it works for me because I like the patient to feel like that they have a partner in whatever it is we're dealing with, and they know we're going to get to the bottom of it. They know we're going to communicate. They know they're going to get the respect, and that they're going to be able to trust my decision making along the way, and then we can talk about different things together. But and it takes time to get there. You're absolutely right. But hopefully, some of these techniques will be helpful. So. You know, and so in Bond, it's been a labor of love, and it's available on Amazon.
Yes.
Also, I have a website, Bond by Dr. Red Cross. So, you know, like I said, it's something that's kind of me on paper. So finally, it's out. Finally. It's been a long journey.
And do you mind sharing one more time exactly where one can get information? You know, the information that you've shared today is just really invaluable.
Sure.
And where can they go to get that? And again, the copy of your book, where can they get that?
Sure. So look, I mentioned a few websites today. One, we were talking about that medicinal mushroom supplement, which is called AHCC, and I mentioned AHCCresearch.org.
Okay.
Look at the studies for yourself. You'll be really excited. I also mentioned getting your omega-3 levels checked. In other words, that fish oil that's protective for our heart, for our brain, and in this case, to increase our white blood cell count, and that's at nutrientpower.org. I also mentioned my site where you can get the book, which is Bond by DrRedCross.com, or if you put in Dr. Red Cross on Amazon with Bond beside it, it'll come up. And if you want information on some of the things we talked about, my website is drredcross.com. That's drredcross.com. Facebook is Ken Red Cross MD, and Twitter is at Dr. Red Cross.
Listen, Dr. Red Cross, I just want to extend my sincere appreciation to you. It's been very helpful, and I appreciate it. To my listening audience, I want to say thank you for your time and your ear. Get you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.